And I'm very glad that you're here as well. And I like to play with fire, but we're going to get this just right here.
I shut it off so you don't.
Thank you.
So the assignment is...
The assignment is to get the sound right, and we'll just talk a little bit till we do that. The assignment really is to have a conversation with Henry, and you all get to listen in, and then if there's time, you can ask questions. So I think I'll just set right in. Henry Schrock is here, and I'm Leroy Hirschberger, as most of you know. And you just had your 90th birthday, right?
Well, a week or so ago.
Yes. And to get back to the other end of your life, we have to go all the way to 1925. And I was surprised to learn that you were born in Amity, near Amity, Oregon, in Yamhill County.
That's correct.
Yeah, and that's in the Willamette Valley, just up the road from where my sister lives right now. And we have a picture of the house that we think you were born in or lived in after you were born. So for everyone's edification, that still stands 90 years later. Now, that didn't last long. Your dad moved, and he moved to Medford, Wisconsin, when you were a year old. And that's where you grew up.
Yes, we may have lived there longer than it sounded when you said it so. That is, I was born there. But how much before I was born, I don't know.
Your parents may have lived there before you were born. Now that comes to, this is something I did have an idea. Your family has 13 children in it, and you are the youngest.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what I'd like, this barn, this is the barn that you milk cows in up in Wisconsin, right?
It might be.
It might be.
We had two barns.
Oh, you had two barns. Well, this looks like a milk barn to me. Well, I'd like you to just tell us a little bit of just a memory of something from church or school from the Medford days, because this is when you were a young boy, way back there.
All right. I could probably tell on myself here. To begin with, I was started to school when I was 5 years old, and I didn't want to go to school, and so I walked out with the others and hid in the ditch.
How long did that last?
I don't know, but I went to school.
Eventually, your parents caught on. Yeah, well, I felt like doing that sort of thing myself already. Yeah. So, tell us a little bit what it's like to be the youngest of 13.
Well, it's kind of like this. I was with my dad out in the yard after church one Sunday, and there were two other men standing beside us, and my dad was visiting with them. I suddenly or otherwise realized that I wonder who these two men are. Are they my brothers? And they were.
And they were. Just two big old Amish men turned out to be his brothers.
My two oldest brothers.
Your two oldest brothers.
And the youngest.
Uh-huh. So we're going to move ahead. You lived in Medford. I have one little thing to point out about Medford for people who don't know. There was back and forth between Buchanan County, Iowa, where I was born, and Medford. There were families that moved up to Medford. And back in the day, when single women went to visit in Medford from Buchanan County, their friends would say, "Now you better watch out. You'll come back with a red-haired boyfriend." So is there any basis for truth in that?
There were a few red-haired people in our church, yes.
In your church, uh-huh.
That mostly, I can't think of any of them that were not my brothers.
Your brothers? I'm sorry my mom's not here. She would find that very amusing. Yeah.
Well, so you went to school after the ditch episode, and you were a young folk with the Medford group there, and you were Amish, and this was during World War II.
It was before World War II and during World War II.
And during. So did you talk a lot about the war while you were...
Actually, I was not going to school during the war. But, I was 18 years old, for instance, when I registered for the draft.
Were you called up then?
With a number of other people, I think there were 6 busloads of northern Wisconsin youth that had to go to Milwaukee for physical checkups.
And you were with them?
And I was with them.
So then what happened?
Well, on the way down, it was not very pleasant for us Amish boys. Everybody had a great time. And plus that, the boys prevailed on the driver to stop at a tavern, and that didn't help it any.
So it wasn't just Amish on this bus?
No, there were 6 Amish boys on the bus.
Ah, on the bus. And the rest of these were going to sign up for, or they were drafted and they were going to go to war.
The same as we, yes.
So you had a little alcohol mixed in with the problems that they presented.
On the way down, yes.
So you got there, and then what happened? Tell us a little more. Just
there was a speech in the evening, and one of the things I remember, the person in charge saying was that if you do not look like you had just hibernated in a forest up north, you're pretty well assured that you will get along well in the army.
So he was what does that mean? Look like you hibernated up north?
Well, to me, it meant that he was kind of noticed these 6 fellows, Amish fellows.
So you look like you've been hibernating?
Well, it appeared that way to me.
To him, uh-huh.
But I will say that when we went through the line, long line, from door to door, at one particular room, they closed the door when I got in. And everyone else, I don't know, did they wait or did they go around? But these fellows started asking me about faith, about what faith I had. And we had a good visit there. And when they were ready for me to sent me on, they wished me the Lord's blessings, and I went on. And on the way home then, there was no more frivolity. Everybody was released. They were...
So were you required to do alternative service?
No.
No, you weren't.
Well, I was deferred.
You were deferred. You had a farm deferment.
That's right.
And before that was over, the war ended. Is that how that worked?
Yes.
Pretty much. Okay, very good. So here you were in Medford, and, you know, it was a good community, but you were 22 years old, and you were ready to go see the world. Where's the first place you went after this foray to Milwaukee? I'm thinking of the winter you went off out east.
Oh. Well, I the first place I went was to visit my sister, who lived in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. And we expected...
It's just a young you. Wait, too far. Go back.
And my brother and I went, and we expected to get a job in a sugar can. Making maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody hired for that.
So what did you do
and
instead?
So we got a job sawing down trees for a fellow who wanted to whose barn had burnt down.
And you were sawing the trees to make the lumber for the new barn.
Exactly.
Got it.
My brother and I found out one thing. My brother knew something about felling trees.
Uh-huh.
And when the other people wanted to, had a leaning tree, we had a leaning tree, and they wanted to get a rope on it to make sure it fell that way. My brother told them, no, that's not necessary. And he knew just how to make the cuts so that that tree fell where they wanted it.
So hibernating in northern Wisconsin actually taught him some good lessons there. Good.
He knew more than I did.
Very good. All right, so you did that, and then did you return home to Wisconsin?
We did.
And then you made another foray out. Was it that fall? And you were about, what, 23 years old maybe?
Oh, something like that.
And where did you go next?
We went to Kelowna, Iowa.
Kelowna, Iowa. And what did
I did.
You did.
With a friend.
Yes. And what was that about? What were you planning to do there?
Oh, we were planning to husk corn.
By hand?
I had never husked corn. In Medford, no one raised ripe corn.
Uh-huh. It was silage corn.
Yes.
I see. And so did that turn out then?
No.
Why not?
Corn pickers came in, took away our jobs.
Uh-huh. See, now, if you'd have asked, if you'd have gone 120 miles north to Buchanan County, they still didn't have corn pickers. You could have got a job there. But instead, you went to work for Andy Beachy.
Oh, yes. Not immediately.
But you did get a job
there.
But
I got a job there, always 1 month at a time.
A month at a time. Did he pay you once a month?
Yes.
And what was that? How much did you get paid? This was back in about 1947.
I was paid $45 a month.
And all you can eat?
Yes,
yeah,
and a bed.
And a bed, yeah. So that was wages. And what did you do? Andy was a horse farmer? And did he have cattle?
He was a hog farmer, and he had horses.
A hog farmer, and he had horses. Okay. So you didn't milk the hogs.
And he was also a dairyman.
And he had dairy cows as well.
And he built a barn, an addition to the barn that year, and I helped on that.
You helped on that. Okay, now that's what you did just for your wages. But tell us a little bit about some new things you learned from... I think it was Andy who told you about this. He had a son who was off, was he in Puerto Rico or something? Mose?
Yes, he was. Yeah. Yes, he did.
And he talked, he started talking about acronyms like MCC and CPS and things like that.
I knew about those things, but they were vague.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So what did you do?
Well, there were other things going on in Iowa, in those Iowa churches at that time, especially among the young people or the younger married people. And I was learning more about things that one could do as a Christian than just farming well.
Huh. So you're looking outside of northern Wisconsin community things. There you go. So what did you do then? You wrote a letter, right?
I did.
So you must have gone to school long enough to learn to read and write.
I did.
Tell us about that and what it was about.
I wrote a letter to MCC, mm-hmm. and they accepted me. In November.
We're not going to check up on this, so don't worry about which month it was.
Okay. That fall, they asked me to come to Akron to Akron, Pennsylvania, MCC headquarters, for, what do you call that?
Oh, for orientation.
Orientation.
Right. Right, yeah, you have to be oriented if you're going to work for MCC.
At that time, you did.
Yep. And then they sent you to Gulfport, Mississippi.
That's right.
Yeah, and I've heard that before. And what did you do when you got there? You were telling me about hookworm control. That sounds really important.
Is there anyone here who was at NTPS at Gulfport?
From the audience. Oh, he's not here. I'm so sorry. And your mom was. Right. And other people that used to live here were there as well.
Yes.
And they lived in barracks.
I don't know where those earlier people lived. But by the time I got there, we were moving or had moved buildings from a no longer used army base.
So you had dorms. You had girls' dorms and
boys' dorms.
And tell us.
In between.
Yeah. And so you were doing community projects.
Yes.
That was much better than milking cows and feeding the hogs in Kelowna. Right?
Well, it probably was.
Yeah. It was a change. Absolutely a change. And so tell us how you did the hookworm control.
The hookworm control was simply by making concrete slabs so that whoever received these concrete slabs could put a little building on it. And
call it an outhouse.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what he was doing with his friends is he pour a slab of concrete with a little riser, which became the toilet. And it was all set, ready to use, and if people wanted privacy, they had to put up the walls themselves. But that was the way they controlled for hookworms. Because I guess they knew, and you controlled them, and that was good. What else did you do? You helped poor farmers.
We did.
So what was one farmer? Well, and that's you, down at the camp. And you look like you're having a really good time there. So you would go out and, what was it, a cucumber farmer? You picked cucumbers?
We did. I didn't.
You didn't, but some people did that.
Yes.
Okay. And then that, not the only thing, but at the end of the day, you had free time, which is unheard of on a farm. And then, what was it? You had a rec room and a ping pong table.
Exactly.
Right, and had you ever played ping pong before you went to this camp?
No.
No. No, but you were a quick learner, and there was a Mennonite there, the guy who kind of ran the boys' dorm. And what was his name? Orva? Ori? Orlo. Orlo Kaufman. And he was a master at ping pong, and he, you know, let people know. And did you, you gave him, what did you do? You gave him a run for the money, didn't
you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and we're very proud of that, we from. Yeah, absolutely. Now, the other thing with that spare time in the evening, the next picture, please. There were girls there, too. Well, too far. Go back one. We have to look at this a second. Now, those are Mennonite girls there, except you can probably pick out two Amish ladies. And both of them you will know when we point them out to you. To the that side is Mary, now Beachy. She was Miller then. She would be David L.'s sister. She was down there. And then over here, Elizabeth Miller. And she's now Schrock. But we'll get to that a little bit later. Now you said you did not go there to look for a wife or girlfriend.
No.
Not at all. But you also told me that you remember once having a free day and going down to the ocean, right? And you sat on a pier. Who did you sit on a pier with in the moonlight?
Well, it was an evening, to be exact, but then there were others of the group as well, but we kind of went off to ourselves, Elizabeth and I.
And you did, because you were one of the few Amish people there.
That's right.
Right, and you have to support your local Amish woman. We appreciate that, too. Yeah, very good. So while you were still there, you were working for some time, you were contacted by MCC and they needed you somewhere else.
They had, MCC at that time was still doing a lot of work in Europe and to help out refugees. And they wanted an Amish presence there. They had one, and he had gone home, or was going home. And so they came down and asked if there were any of the Amish boys. And there were several of us at that time. Clarence Stutzman was there. Maybe not anymore. And John Hirschberger from Iowa. At any rate, they asked for which one of us would want to go to Europe, and I went to Europe.
Very good. But before you did that, there are a few more things. Next picture. I just want to point out that the schoolhouse where some of the people came to teach religion classes, those schoolhouses didn't look quite as good as the ones up northern Wisconsin, where the Amish went to school. And then other exciting things that you did, next picture.
This was a black school.
That was a black school, and that was unusual.
For black children.
In that time, for black people to be there. Let's go back to that truck has a name. What's the name of that truck?
Well, can't see.
It's the one that's stuck. I think you got it stuck.
Hootenanny.
Yeah, it had a name. Trucks had names back in those days, and this one's name was Hootenanny. And somehow or another, the doors are missing, and I don't see any shoulder straps in there either. But it looks to me like they were having fun with that, mudding. So anyway, that's kind of the end of that. So you went off in about 1950 or late 49, you went to Europe after you were in Akron.
That's right.
And what's the first place you went to?
Espelkamp.
And tell us just a little bit about what Espelkamp was and what you turned it into.
Espelkamp was a military...
A storage place.
Storage place.
Yeah. So big and, storage buildings.
And, yes, they were big warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some smaller buildings, too, for officers' quarters and so on.
And this was after the war, and there were a lot of displaced people, a lot of Volksdeutsch. These would be German-speaking families who had lived in Poland and in Russia, and they were fleeing, and they had no place to go. And so here they were at this big warehouse, this camp or whatever with warehouses, and you worked as a carpenter.
Yes.
And what did you do here?
We did anything that they...
But you changed those buildings into apartments for people
right.
to live in.
We knocked holes in them for windows. We put in doors. The buildings became duplexes. And we put wood floors in them.
And people still live in those buildings in Espelkamp. And in 1985, I hitchhiked from Bad Bergzabern up to Espelkamp. It's in northern Germany. And I stayed at Jutta's parents' house. Jutta was just this beautiful German girl I met at the ski camp in Switzerland. And she invited me to stop in. And I stayed in one of those apartments that you probably knocked a hole in so they could have a window. And it was quite comfortable.
It was.
It was quite comfortable on a cold
good.
Day. Yeah, and they were very kind. They remembered the kindnesses that American Amish had visited on them. And Yuda's mother saw that I had holes in my socks. And in the morning when I left to go hitchhike further, she gave me this wonderful pair of socks. She worked at a sock factory. And they were just beautiful, just perfectly made German socks. And I still have them. It's like 30 years later, and they only have one little hole in one of them. It's a wonderful pair of socks. So anyway, Espelkamp, and then you worked in Frankfurt, in a suburb of Frankfurt.
Yeah. Could I...
Yes.
Is it a proper time to say
yeah.
something about
talk
this?
Talk about the candlestick.
All right. Espelkamp had lots of refugees, and... Some of them had gotten work. This particular stand here was made by a fellow who worked for Stahlhof. Stahlhof was the place where the government of the city of Espelkamp was located, but before that it was for officers' quarters. But this man came to me and said he'd like to make something for me before I go home. And so I said, well, fine, but what do I owe you? And he looked around and said, what about that jacket you've got on? So... I said, fine. And a few days later, he came back with this stand.
Yeah. And you may not be able to see.
He made it himself.
Yeah, I don't know if you can see it very well, but it's wrought iron. It's beaten. It's there's brass brazing on here. Brazing class, take notice. This is welded together here, and these are beaten out here. So it's really a pretty nice piece of metalwork, and I spotted it and liked it, and so I'm very glad you brought that with the story, and you traded it for a coat. I think you got a really good trade. I'm sure that coat is long gone. Yeah, so you went down and you helped clean up rubble
okay.
in a suburb of Frankfurt,
mm-hmm.
and you built a sturdy-built building, the very first one probably.
Could be.
A mini barn.
Actually, we got the rubble out of the way.
First.
First.
And why was it important to build the barn in this lady's little tiny backyard?
Okay, that was back at Espelkamp then. But everybody did that kind of thing. That it wasn't just this lady, but she was a widow, had a young daughter, and never did hear what happened to her husband. But it's very likely that he was a casualty in the war. But the lady had one of these houses that we had, somebody had knocked holes in, and she was living in the house. But she also had a goat and some chickens, and they needed a place to be. So one of the rooms for that house became the place where the goat and the chickens. Mm-hmm.
Because at this time and in this place, a goat and chickens were valuable stuff, and you didn't just let them be outside if
That's
they didn't have
right.
a good place. So she had them in her house with her, and Henry came and built a barn for them.
We did.
Very good, and I'm sure she's still grateful.
I have some pictures for the that show that.
Yeah, and we don't have those pictures, but trust me, he's telling the truth. So You worked for almost 2 years in Europe.
That's right.
And then you came home back to the States, but you didn't go to Medford right away, or did you?
I did.
But then what was the next stop?
Oh, Iowa, I think, and then Kansas.
And then Kansas. You came to Hutchinson. And what brought you here? What drew you here?
Well, I had been writing letters to Elizabeth,
uh-huh.
and that's what drew me here.
And this is what he met when he came here. That's Lizzie's dad, Will, and he lived right over here where the Oatneys live now. And he ran a really ship-shaped farm, and he had beautiful daughters. And were you intimidated when you first saw him?
I don't remember that I was.
Uh-huh, yeah. He was young and foolish, obviously. Very good. So you came here, and somehow or another, you ended up marrying Elizabeth.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And somebody got a picture of you about that time. Look at that. Wow. And where did you live right at the beginning after you married?
I had a job, a farm job, about a mile south and a half mile east of where Abe Yoder lived.
Okay, I'll just tell you that was where Cameron Pierce lives now, next to Clinton Pierce, because people don't my people don't
That's
remember
right.
Abe
That's
Yoder.
Right.
Yeah, and tell us where you live. What exactly was the house that you lived
well,
in?
Well, we lived on the north side of the road, and that there was, they had put there an insulated railroad car box. Actually, they put one and a half railroad cars there. It was in a T shape. Well, it was insulated. It was not bad to get to heat. But that's where we started we lived there when we had our first child.
Very good. So in case you're wondering, life can start out pretty well in a boxcar. And this is a picture. The little boy there with his hand on his nose is Wesley Schrock, just for the people of you who might be interested. I like that one because of that. But that's a dapper young Henry and Elizabeth with their four children. So not long after this, you decided you wanted to go to school. And you went to Heston College, and Why did you do that? What did you want to do?
I wanted to teach, but I only taught 1 year.
So you got a degree, or you got a certificate?
Associate degree.
You got an associate's degree from Heston College in education, and then you went to work teaching. And this was at the Buckeye School, which was over on Broadacres Road, right?
That's right.
So tell us, how many grades did you have?
Well, there was an eighth grader and there was a first grader.
And how many students altogether?
I think there were 7 or 8 students altogether.
Altogether. And that lasted for 1 year, and then consolidation closed that school, and it was kind of a small school already. So that was the end of your teaching, your formal teaching then.
Mm-hmm.
So you started doing some farming then.
Oh.
And you ended up farming about 120 acres, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a house that got moved in over on Broadacres. You lived there. This picture was probably from that era. And you tried some other things. You told me that you did bees, that you had bees, that you were hoping to make a little extra money with bees.
We did.
You had 110 hives.
At one time.
How did that work out? Did you make a lot of money?
I couldn't make a living on 110 hives.
Uh-huh.
But it helped.
It helped, and you had plenty of honey then, too.
We did.
Right. Very good. And then you told me you did some carpentry as well. And you said you worked for Ettinger Construction, and that was South Hutch, right?
Before that, I worked for Jimmy Glass.
Uh-huh.
And there are other people out here who worked there at the same time.
Same time. So who are, name some of them.
Sam Nisley.
Sam D.
Yes.
And who else? There's somebody who's not
here.
Well,
I imagine Christy worked there too, didn't he?
Christy Yoda. You worked for Mr. Glass.
Or his brother did, Fred.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and another person that worked with you about that time was your wife's brother-in-law, Hans. Is how I know him, but
oh,
John.
Okay.
So I knew his wife, Emma Hunt's coming.
Afterwards,
yeah. And then Mr. Glass said at some point you needed a name for your business.
Somebody did.
Yeah, and then you came up with a name. What was that?
Somebody did. Somebody came up with a name. We asked the crew that we had. Isn't that right, Sam? For ideas.
And what was the name?
Forgotten.
It starts
it's,
with a...
It's still around
It's
here.
Prairie. Prairie
yes,
Construction,
that's right?
That's right. Yeah, and that still exists right over here through several iterations. So it started right here.
I think Sam had more to do with that than I did.
Okay. 51-49 is how we'll divide that up. So you were working with Hans... And you were moving a house or doing a basement over where Shane lives, where Shane and Dorcas live. That was for David L. And you had a terrible accident.
That's
and,
right.
And John died there. Your friend and the person you were working with.
My brother-in-law.
Your brother-in-law.
He didn't die there. He died in the hospital. But
from injuries that he got there. Was it a wall that fell down and squished him? Did you finish that building then, or did you just quit?
Finished the building, but not that day.
Okay, you took a little break. Yeah. That must have been a terribly hard thing to do. I've had setbacks, but nothing quite that hard. Yeah, but you persevered and kept on going. Well, this is about the time. Was this before or after 1959? Were you still Amish, or were you Beachy Amish then? And I don't know that it really matters, but what matters is if you're beachy Amish, you're done with your horse and buggy, and you have to get a car. And in that time and in that place, you went right over here to Fairview Service, and you talked with, was it Dan Yutzi? Dan Yutzi was a car trader. He would have been a horse trader, but, you know, he was conservative. And he had this wonderful car. It only had a couple, 50 or 75,000 miles on it?
Oh, I don't know.
And he traded it from someone up in Red Lake. And you bought it, and you drove it around, and you left that little cross and that, I can't even read it there, something about Red Lake Gospel Mission on the side there. Your very first car. Did you have any misgivings about leaving your horse and buggy?
No.
No, okay. No misgivings, yeah. Well, it's good that way, I guess. So here you were, and you just sort of carried on doing prairie construction and farming and whatever you could. And then in 1971, you said Wanderlust struck. And you moved. You went all the way up to Minnesota. And you started an outreach, or you moved to an outreach?
We moved to a place where there were 8 families of
Beachy Amish. Were they all from here, this area, or mostly?
No.
Not.
There were some from, one from Illinois.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter, but you moved up from a large community to a small one. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the draw, was that you kind of liked the idea of spreading yourselves out, and a small community appealed to you. So if you do the next picture, you can see what happened almost immediately. In a small community, everybody has to help. And so they immediately put you on the school board.
No.
Well, okay, a couple of months later.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, you're so precise. And so you were on the school board, and you helped organize and manage the parochial school, and then the next thing is they ordained a minister, and...
It was the other way around.
Oh, that came first. First you were minister, and then a school board member. Mm-hmm. And here are some of the ministers back in the day, and if you see, I think it's the second person from that side over is a younger Henry there with his colleagues. And so, tell me just one really good perk about being a minister. Like, what? Give me an advantage.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. You study the Bible more.
Uh-huh.
Much more.
This would become more conversant with the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good perk. We'll leave it at that. And then if you go to the next picture, this is in 2000, and that's a plaque with a little picture in it. And this is what Henry got as his retirement, from the ministry. And that's out front, in front of Believers Fellowship Church there. Let's just click to the next picture. Now that you're retired, this is one little thing I want you to just talk about very briefly. You collect stamps, and you organize them very carefully with a Scott numbering system. And you spend a lot of time, but how much money do you spend doing this?
I don't know.
What you told me most of the stamps in here cost 20 cents if you buy them.
Yes.
They're used, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. So I just want to point out that if anybody here is interested in collecting stamps, it doesn't take a big outlay of capital. And why would one collect stamps?
It's fun. It's interesting. It's you get to see other people's idea of what's important.
And it's like a history lesson,
yes,
too. Because these are organized. Scott organizes them by years. And then you can see what was important in 1922 or 1956. It's more fun than reading a history book sometimes. So you did some other things as well. Next picture.
This is Elizabeth in Haiti holding a little Haitian. And then the next picture. And that, I think, is Henry right there in the yellow shirt. And you're building something. What is that building?
The building was at La Baleine. Local masons had put up the walls. And then people from the States, a group of people from the States, helped put up the roof. The building was used. It has two floors. The bottom floor was used, half of it for a school to teach ladies sewing classes, making quilts, counting blocks. Some of them didn't know how to do that, quilt blocks. The other half was a shop. Now, Irvin Stutzman was the head of that, of the La Baleine organization at that time. And he was also a good fellow to fix anything that a Haitian could bring, almost, so they could use it again. Mm-hmm. Sewing machines.
Yeah, so this is still going on today in La Baleine?
As far as I know.
And here's an idea if some of you feel like stopping with the feeding the pigs and the milking the cows, or ministry even, you can go to this sort of thing.
The upper floor was a high school. Uh-huh.
Very good. So next picture. So here we are. This is the not so long ago Henry with the more adult children and Lizzie looking on there. This must have been, what, 20 years ago, maybe? Doesn't really matter about that era. Yeah. And then, finally, the last picture brings us almost here. And it's Henry and Lizzie in 2010. And this is about the time that you moved back to Kansas from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of gone full circle, kind of, here. Started out your married life here, and did many years of service in other places, and certainly in Minnesota, and you're back again because you're close to one of your children, Wesley Schrock here. Well, that's just kind of a quick circle through your life, and for the last thing here, we have a little story, and I'll set it up, and then you take it from the most important part. And this goes back a few years when Henry lived in...
Minnesota,
and he had carpenters out, and they were ripping off shingles, and he had this man named Tom de Bogart, Vanda Bogart, who had come to the church, needed a place to stay, and lived at Henry's house briefly. And so Tom was kind of a nervous fellow, and he was looking around, and he said, "Henry, I saw somebody slip into the barn." And you said, "Oh, it was just one of the people who have calves out in the pasture. It's no big deal." And Tom had to let it go. Well, later when the carpenters had left and were cleaning up the tools and Tom took a pitchfork into the barn, you heard him start talking to somebody. And he was excited. He's an excitable guy. But you went over to find out. And tell us what you found.
Okay, by that time, a fellow was standing in the doorway to the milk house. When Tom got into the barn, he heard something upstairs, and he said, "That's funny. Henry doesn't have anything upstairs anymore." So he went up. There was a hole up on both ends of the barn, on either end of the barn. And so here he saw a man on the other end of the barn, and he was peeking out the cracks to see what he could see. And Tom asked him if he needed any help, and the man came down right away. He came. And so that's where I met them then. That's where Tom did his loud speaking. I didn't know what was wrong, but the man had no shoes. His socks were worn through, and I talked to him, and I did not feel nervous at all talking to him, but I did some of the things that were said and some of the things that the man said. I did begin to think and look him over very carefully. He had just rather light trousers on, and I thought that if he would have something dangerous on him, I could surely see it, but I could not see anything.
No guns, no knives.
No, yeah. Nothing. No bulges. It was evening. The fellows that were there working went to Eden Valley, our town, to play ball. It was the 4th of July, and they wanted to go to play ball. And so I didn't know what to do here, but I invited this man in for supper. No, he does not want to come into the house. And another thing that he did say is, I won't hurt you, as though he might have been capable of doing that. But I said, it's about supper time, let's go in and eat. No, he didn't want to do that. I said I'd bring him a plate out to eat, with a plate of food. And I did, but Lizzie wondered what's going on, and I went downstairs. I'm not sure whether Tom was in the house then already or not, but I did not want Tom to know what I was doing, because Tom was an easy talker, that is, he, and I didn't want him to know. Well, I called our deacon, Paul Chupp. What shall I do? And we ended up by having him call the sheriff's office and just nonchalantly asking, is anything wrong in that the sheriff might be interested in? And from there on, business picked up. There was nothing nonchalant about it anymore.
Now, you had already brought a plate of food out for this fugitive, right?
Not then yet, but then I did.
And what else did you give him?
I gave him a pair of shoes that were I had worn out for myself. But they were better than nothing, and gave him a pair of shoes. Well, he sat down and put them on. But then I took the I took the food out, and he accepted it. We went back in and ate supper, and the phone went, and here it was the sheriff. And he was all business. He said, asked a few questions, can you get to the car? Is the man in your house? Answer yes or no. And I told him, and when he asked if I could get to the car, and I said yes, he said, you'd be out here in 60 seconds. And that was just outer driveway. We had a rather long driveway, outer driveway, and then a quarter mile north. Well, we were very nearly, but the people who were there said the sheriff was getting antsy when it was getting to be 60 seconds. Well, just about then, he got a telephone call. I don't know what kind of machines did they use in those days.
I think not smoke signals, but maybe Morse code or something. This was back in the 70s or 80s.
At any rate, a mile west on the north and south road, one of the sheriff's helpers was sitting there looking at us. Looking at us, yes. And then I found out that, yes, they were on all around us. This fellow said, I see a man. He's walking south of your grove on the field road beside the cornfield. And the sheriff said, let's go. And he and a few others went, and they got the man. The thing that surprised me was that they found pockets full of shotgun shells on him. And they looked around at the fence row there, which had more weeds, and they found a shotgun there, a sawed-off shotgun.
That he had abandoned when he saw he was being caught.
Yes.
Uh-huh. He would have had that hidden somewhere, maybe in your milk house or something,
I think he must have.
Uh-huh. Because it wasn't your shotgun.
It wasn't my shotgun.
Wow. And so...
Well, the sheriff took him to town, and he was eventually taken, sent to prison.
Right, and the reason he was sent to prison is that morning he'd had a fight, or something went wrong, and he was upset with his girlfriend and shot her to death. And then he had made his escape and ended up at your barn. Mm-hmm. Where you offered him a meal and gave him shoes and weren't afraid. And some of the neighbors who heard that story said, good thing he didn't show up at our barn. Or we wouldn't have treated him as nicely as old Henry did.
I didn't quite hear the story that way. But
it was something close. Like I'm about 55% right. Right. And the other thing that you learned is the detectives from Minneapolis said that this sort of thing happens more often during holidays, 4th of July and stuff.
Yes.
Violent crimes,
yes,
and stuff like that. So beware. of those holidays coming up. Well, the point I want to make here is, first of all, thank you very much for speaking to us. But I want to point out that I've been reading David Brooks, and he's really focused on what makes life meaningful and valuable. And so people write into him, and these are the things he says. He says, when you're young, you think that doing a really big, important thing is what life is all about. But he said, the older people that write to me and talk about what makes life meaningful and valuable say, all I want to do is just naturally respond in kindness to people and just do little things that make life better. That's what I want to do. And I think this story illustrates that. Another thing that people are concerned about is fear. And I think a wonderful story of not being afraid. And I think that approach helped the outcome of this story. Thank you very much, Henry, for telling us and for living your life and for coming here to do your last years with us. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I think you
did very well.
Oh, I'm glad you think so. I think we'll just close quietly. I'll blow out the candles and turn the time over to you. I can switch the notes.
Whom all blessings flow, praise him, all creatures here below.